Thin Digital Line. Policing in the year 2045.
Hello, I'm Jason Harwin and welcome to the first episode of Thin Digital Line. During the series, we're going to be exploring how the world of digital data and technology will impact on policing by the year 2045. I'm going to be meeting with the most senior influential leaders in policing, along with the private sector experts who will be exploring the police service in singularity, artificial intelligence and surveillance, big data, cyber and fraud crime, change and the workforce for the future. In today's episode, I'm delighted to be joined by, firstly, Chief Constable Gavin Stephen, QPM, who's the MPCC Chair with responsibility of working with all police forces, chief constables, to improve policing for the public. Hello, Gavin.
Nice to see you.
Secondly, I'm joined by Tony Baker, QPM, former Deputy Chief Constable in Kent Police, and now the Chief of Staff supporting Chief Constable Rob Carden, who's the MPCC lead for digital data and technology. Hi, Tony.
Morning, Jason.
And finally, but not least, Alistair Hendry, who is the Executive Director from the award-winning digital transformation company Exception.
Good morning.
Okay, so today we're going to start off by talking about the prediction by Ray Kurzweil in relation to technology. And now in 2045, it is thought that technology through AI, artificial intelligence, will be able to do everything a human brain can, including emulating someone's voice and movement. What does that mean for policing and the wider criminal justice system in 2045? So to get started, let's have a little look back firstly. So Gavin, 21 years ago, what was policing like then?
Oh, very different. This is my 31st year in policing, so maybe I'll paint you a little picture from 31 years ago, which was an image of my tutor, Lee, walking down the corridor at Bridge Street Police Station in Peterborough with a huge stack of paper under his arm, which were physical crime reports, carbonated different coloured paper that then go into an office for somebody to sift through that paper, look for patterns and trends, maybe try and match them up with photographs and previous report. That manual process, so cue forward to today, where we've got good quality algorithms looking across data, spotting patterns and trends for us, facial recognition technology. It's really come on. I always remember in my passing out parade, a senior officer saying to me, "You're never going to believe how much policing is going to change in your time." And it certainly has. No sat nav, no iPhones, none of that, beyond recognition. But one thing is exactly the same. And that's that policing is about dealing with human endeavour, often human frailty, supporting people on sometimes what's the worst day in their life, and that will not change in the future either.
And we'll certainly come back to that, because that's really important, isn't it? When we start talking about data and digital and technology, there's a human being behind all that still, in sense of the service we provide to the public. So, Tony, your reflections, last 21 years.
Yeah, and like Gavin, I'll say, what's really interesting is that the first computer I saw in policing, PNC, is still running. It's still a green screen. And it's about to be decommissioned, but
still works.
It still works. It does. When I think back to 2003, the test question of what's happened in the last 21 years, we would have single systems for looking after crime, intelligence, custody, quite a fragmented set of applications that'd be built up over time. We didn't have airwave radios, so we had the old UHF press-to-talk radios. I think in the last 21 years, there's been a massive, massive change for police technology. I remember coming on duty and having a Z printer of paper coming off with the jobs, people tearing off a piece of paper from the printer. Whereas now there's mobile devices in every officer's hand, so you can push information data to people. You can do an ANPR check at the side of the road onto a national database from your mobile phone. You've got integrated records management systems where all of our information is in a poll data store, and you've got the proliferation of cloud-based services. So we're starting to be able to connect and move data around and use it. And as Gavin says, starting to see some really interesting advanced analytics coming through that tell us things that we couldn't find out by ourselves. I think that's the big change. We're starting to understand things that we couldn't see ourselves from the data.
And I think certainly from my side, I reflect, I think I was as a PC then, 21 years ago, the old fax machine. So the only way you connected realistically was a fax machine, and know very well most of the time it didn't have paper in it, so it didn't actually turn out the other end. So again, that point around connecting not just police forces, but the wider criminal justice system, and then importantly connecting with the public, has certainly changed over the last 21 years, hasn't it? Let's look outside policing. Alistair, your observations, 21 years, public, private sector?
You know, when I was thinking about this question, actually, if you take back 25 years ago, we were all worried about year 2000, planes falling out of the sky, IT was going to collapse. And we've moved on a fair distance since we got past that point. You know, if we start to look at how people have been interacting with technology, how technology itself's progressed. Amazon, things like that, the direct service to you, online banking, digital banking, all of those things that weren't a thing back then. So the consumer of digital technology has completely changed.
And importantly, how much is the thing that's happening outside policing influencing policing? What's been your observations?
So basically the cultural change, I think, of technology. It's now the direct interface. It's now the single point people communicate with each other. It's the way you buy stuff. It's the way you shop for things. It's the way you interact with the world. Whereas previously it was a very community-driven thing. That community thing is now globalised. Technology impact on the country has been massive.
So let's pilot ahead to 2045, okay? And taking account of the predictions by Kurzweils and obviously the issue around singularity, Gavin, had an opportunity to think about what it might look like. What's your initial thoughts around how policing might be different in 2045?
Well, I think the first thing to look at is what's happening with global trends, climate and environment, migration, war, conflict, human endeavour. In amongst all of that, policing has a role to play, in our terms, in the UK context, of keeping the King's peace. So being able to be that broker of community tension, I don't think that changes whether you're talking about 45 years from now or 100 years from now. You know, if you look back in history, we've always needed to do that. But what I can say with confidence is that the decisions that we make in order to do those things will be much better informed by the technology that we've got, as long as the technology is connected to the people and as long as the people have got confidence in the technology. So one of the things I wonder about is that in order for policing to work effectively, we have to have confidence. If you like, it's our share price on which we trade. And at the moment, that's largely driven by whether we understand the issues that matter to people and are dealing with them. I think in the future, it'll also be affected by whether people think we can be trusted to look after their data and information well, what we know about them, whether we use that ethically and wisely. But if we do, if we overcome those things, then policing should have the opportunity to become much more precise through tools that we can already see emerging now to enable us to identify offenders, better protect victims, understand patterns and trends in order to prevent them at source. It will enable colleagues on the front line to make stronger and better decisions on the basis of reliable information. And then the around that, who knows? I mean, we're already experimenting with smart uniform that adjusts to the environment, that can protect them from threats and so on. And then probably the final thought is that there are jobs that exist now, data scientists, that didn't exist 21 years ago, and there will be jobs that exist in the future that we can't even imagine now, but will be very relevant to policing.
And Tony, from your side, obviously policing's aimed to adapt now to some of the challenges. So again, artificial intelligence is already here, isn't it? It's happening now. What do you see as some of the opportunities and risks around the technology at the moment?
I think Gavin made a really interesting point around the proliferation of data and its availability and its aggregation. So there's a real ethical thing around saying is how much do you want to know about the individual citizen and how much do you want to police people? If everything you do with your car, every time you drive it, is available to the police service, then every law you break will be visible. So there's a real thing around proportionality. As Gavin suggests, that kind of contract with the community around what is proportionate, legitimate policing, because you will be able to do much more intrusive policing when you have more data available and you can analyse it. So I think that's a real challenge for us. I think we're always going to be in an arms race with criminality. So all the things that technology provides for us and data provides for us enable to police better, enables opportunities for criminals to commit different types of crime. We've seen that with cybercrime. We've seen that with the ransomware attacks. We've seen that how people exploit the dark web to share indecent images of children. So we're always going to be in a kind of perpetual arms race to ineffectively around how criminals will exploit what data and technology provides for people and how we work with them. And you've seen how it's become borderless. So how do you police a criminal in Venezuela who uses cloud-based technology and the connectedness of our future communities to target a vulnerable person in Dagenham on a Wednesday afternoon? How does a local force do that? So I think it really calls into question how we organise law enforcement nationally, internationally, in a way that understands that people live, as Alistair says, people are living in a virtualised world and data is shared internationally and globally. How do we get around that in terms of our policing style?
And again, if you look out at crime, isn't it? We know that over 50% of crime is related to cyber-related, enabled, fraud-related, and how that's changed over the many years. We've got this enabled technology now. I suppose the important bit is there an opportunity now to start doing some of the prevention work for the future? But recognising, again, things are moving so quickly. Again, the debate isn't about revolution versus evolution. Where are we with this kind of issue? So I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, Tony, about the prevention space.
Well, there is, and there's the online safety bill that's coming through that sort of starts saying to big technology providers that you need to do more to safeguard the people that use your products. But I think it's almost going to be an overwhelming challenge, because it's so complicated and there are so many opportunities for people to exploit vulnerabilities in security, to use communication tools to con people and to steal data and access people's bank accounts, for example, if they wanted to. I think it's just going to be a matter of competing. And the further we think ahead and prepare, the better we're prepared for the thing that's going to happen. And so for me, it's the investment now saying is, and the work we're doing around AI and robotics and other things and looking at how we do cybersecurity better, we've got to start investing in things to strengthen us going forward, as opposed to perhaps as we have been looking at dealing with our legacy.
For me, some of that strengthening is about the law. A lot of our legal system and laws that are constructed around human-to-human interactions, aren't there? And I think we're only just learning in the law how we get strong laws and strong regulations that help protect people against these things. So, for example, one of the things that we were talking about is, would it be possible to put on developers and producers the need to do a criminal impact assessment for new developments in AI? So if you're developing a new tool, you need to understand as the developer and producer of that tool what the potential criminal uses of it are, so we can think how to prevent them. So we're going to need new thinking in order to continue to operate under the rule of law and to do more so with international cooperation as well, because in the UK we can't operate alone, as Tony's described, when the threats are coming globally.
And again, Alistair, from your side, just looking in, thoughts?
Well, I think there's a couple of interesting points there. So, I mean, from a data trust and ethics point of view, I think there's a big piece of work to be done there. I'm pretty certain teenagers and 20-year-olds will quite happily give all their data to Facebook, but if the police came and asked big questions about why do you want that, you know, so there's a huge trust thing to be built into. And then from the AI training point of view, I mean, we've had discussions before about, you know, liability. If you develop software and the software does a crime itself, who's liable? You know, if you didn't encourage it in any way, you know, going back to the singularity point of view, who's liable? Who'd you put up in front of court? You know, is that going to back off developers? Will that slow the whole progress of technology down? So there's quite a lot of that bigger picture piece to be done. I mean, that's not just in policing, that's right across the whole of technology at the moment.
Going back to your point, Tony, one of the challenges for policing, we have to police within the law, don't we? The reality is criminality don't police within the law, and therefore are not constrained in terms of some of the issues that they are looking to do and, again, exploit. I mean, I think we can all probably put a hand up here. As we sit here now, we're probably all getting an email that's trying to con us into responding to that actually is not from the legitimate purpose.
You know, it's interesting because if somebody's house gets burgled, there's still an expectation of a very traditional response. If somebody gets a phishing email, people shrug their shoulders and put it to one side. Or the bank, if they lose some money, the bank will cover it because the bank's business model says people can't be expected to protect themselves from this type of criminality, so therefore we'll indemnify them on a corporate scale. So I think the nature of law enforcement is perhaps changing away from sort of the classical people-to-people interactions where things, wrongdoing is done, to a system where in the digital world is you can't police and enforce the law like you used to.
So I suppose one of the million-dollar questions again, is it for the police to police like artificial intelligence going forward? Can it police it?
Well, whether we like it or not, we have to deal with the harms that are generated by these things because they generate real-world impact. People lose money, livelihoods, lose their lives as a consequence of this stuff. And in policing, you can't walk away from that human suffering. It's always going to be something that's there. The question is, how do you design a response to do that? And that's where, when I look ahead, I think we have to see policing as a much more porous organisation. We're going to need much stronger relationships with industry, with specialists. You know, the way that we construct our budgets and our workforce is going to have to radically change for the future for us to keep pace with this. And I hope if we can get the investment to be there at the edge of those things, then in some ways our productivity should get better and we should have a position where local officers, which are always going to be needed for those local relationships, perhaps spend even more time with the local communities that they do now, And I think that's going to be vital when we're in this sort of trust deficit that we've chatted about, you know. So, you know, times of crisis, at times of need, people need to turn to somebody who they trust. And we have to work really hard to make sure that that endures through all of this, that we could be a, you know, a trusted public service.
So just, again, thinking about that trust piece, which is about the ethical considerations that policing must consider in terms of whatever we do next. Have you any thoughts how that might change, what we're doing now, how it might change for the future?
Yeah, and I think we're on the cusp of some of these conversations now. So if you take live facial recognition, policing's always been in the business of facial recognition. If I think back to Lee, my tutor, with his big bundle of paperwork, you know, we would have pictures on a board or in a little book that we'd look at. We'd have to try and remember them and then see them on the street. So, you know, you could send cops out on the street with a giant Rolodex full of images, or actually you could give them a tool that does that for them. And I think if you explain it like that in community terms, you say, well, yeah, that's a bit smarter actually than carrying around a big ring binder with a load of pictures of people's faces in it. And then if you say, well, by the way, we're only going to use that on those crimes that you're really fearful of, you know, to keep your children safe when they go to a concert, or to protect you from terrorism when you're at a major event, or to apprehend somebody more quickly who's wanted for sexual offending. I think if we have that dialogue with the right oversight and transparency, let people see what we're doing with it, let them have a look at it, let them engage with it, then we'll earn the trust and confidence. And this is going to have to be a process from here on in, I think. It's not something that the police can just do and expect to be trusted on.
And as we know, our young people today will be the future police officers and law enforcement officers. And again, it's building that trust now, isn't it, to get them in position to be able to respond to that as well. What do you see as some of the opportunities, Tony? We talked on some of the challenges. What do you see some of the opportunities?
The opportunities are limitless for policing, because when we start looking at data, if we get our data organised properly and effectively and available in the cloud, we can start combining those with sort of national data sets for health and other agencies. And we can start looking at what's really driving crime, which locations, which people, which crime types are driven by what types of things are happening in society. So you can start, if you want to get into prevention, you can start really starting to understand, well, crime is occurring there. What happened that led to that? You know, educational low attainment or exclusions or other things, or economic factors. So the real data thing is saying is, well, can we use data more effectively? And as we discussed earlier, Jason, we went to see McLaren Racing last week. And when you see how a truly data-driven organisation that understands what data sources inform success, in a very narrow sort of scenario there around winning a race, but if you understand in policing what are the drivers of crime and policing productivity and performance, and actually gather that data and analyse it and take really effective action, you can really transform public services and make sure that people are in the right places with the right information, doing the right things to keep the community safe. So I think the data thing is massively, massively important for us. And I think that's where, if we're going to do anything, we've got to really concentrate on improving.
Yeah, and I know in a future episode, we're going to talk about the importance of data and obviously big data, and again, how that can, again, as you touched on earlier on, Gavin, about make that real difference to the communities that ultimately we're here to protect, aren't we, as well?
I think just on that, Jason, it's a bit about the why question you kind of touched on. If you take it back to large corporates, corporates go, well, we'll give you a free service, but you understand we're using your data to make advertising, to do these kind of things. The why is very clear to everybody. I think with the, you know, going into, say, this is what we're using the data for, this is why we're using the data, that transparency coming out, I think will make a big difference on the whole kind of policy and ethics side of stuff. But I think the legislation is probably going to be the delay point in all of this.
Again, looking outside policing, Alistair, and what you're seeing. So again, I know we're going to talk about artificial intelligence in another episode in more detail, but clearly artificial intelligence is being utilised by other sectors already and to some real benefit. So any thoughts about, again, the implications for policing outside?
Yeah, I mean, I think the beauty at the moment is it's in a bubble. We have time. AI has been talked about as a big thing. But you know, one of the interesting stats that I think is worth remembering is, as good as the GTPs are and, you know, all these online things you use, the amount of training data they've taken in is the equivalent to what a 2-year-old would have learned. So singularity, we're a long, long, long way away from that, you know. So we've got time to look at it. But the real thing is that industry scene at the moment is when it hallucinates, when it's giving wrong answers. And I think that's possibly the biggest risk to policing at the moment in this kind of thing, is false information, people getting the wrong idea about stuff, it dreaming things up that aren't correct. That in a corporate level is a big enough problem. But if you start pushing that right out to everybody, you know, every Joe Public, all of a sudden information gets spun around really quickly, and that turns into a huge problem.
Which, to be fair, Tony, goes back to your issue about data, isn't it? Again, it's got to be right, hasn't it? It's got to be the quality that we need.
Yeah, and I think to build on that point there, so we're in a kind of public safety business. And so people have a high expectation, and rightly so, that we will do things that are high quality and good decisions. So we've got to make sure that any use of AI is really robust and really reliable for the public. The other thing we're constrained by is investment. So the money that's available within policing, we spend a lot of money on technology, but a lot of money spent on the technology we've got now. So there's something around creating that headroom nationally to say that we can actually invest in understanding, exploiting. And there's been some great investments recently from the government in AI and robotics to things to start understanding how we could take advantage of these technologies. Now, we're never going to be creating them because it's way outside of our capacity as a sector. But what we need to be doing is understanding what's coming through that's of good quality, that's reliable, and that could be integrated into our policing model. But we do need some money. As Gavin says, we can't spend all of our money as we've spent it in the past. We've got to spend our money differently going forward.
Yeah, and that's across, I know we've been talking about data quite a bit and insight from information, but this is true on materials, science, biotech, all of these things, modes of transport, all of these things are going to affect policing, how we respond to incidents, how we keep our team safe, how we keep the public safe. All of these things are going to make a difference. And you were asking a moment, Jason, ago, what's one of the opportunities? I think one of the big opportunities is in communication. One of the things in the history of sort of human conflict that leads to conflict is misunderstanding between cultures, between identities, between languages. And we are not that far away from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Babelfish, shall we? You know, imagine a cop on the side of a road now, you know, stopping an HGV on the side of the motorway. They're on Google Translate at the roadside. You know, very soon they're going to have an earpiece that can just speak and it's going to announce in whatever language they need to what's going on. Just that ability to be able to communicate across cultures, across languages, has huge potential for the effectiveness of how we bring people together and avoid conflict, I think.
Just going back to the point then about the challenge around money. So as always, any sector wants more money that can be invested to get the benefit for the public. Obviously, there's lots of conversations taking place at the minute about how we do that. Again, Tony, from your experience, both as a former deputy, but now seeing it as a chief of staff for this area, what can be done within policing to get more investment back in?
Well, there's a thing that says you've got to spend what you've been given wisely. And I think what we can do nationally is to look really hard at the existing investments, and turning things off is quite hard when you've been relying on them. But say, what could you have instead of what you've currently got? And are you prepared to perhaps turn some things off and stop spending money there and actually create the headroom? So I think the first call is always to say, what do you spend your current? And I think it's about 17, 18 billion pounds spent on policing, about 1.5 billion pounds spent on technology. That's quite a lot of public money. So the first call has always got to be saying is can we be more ruthlessly efficient with what we've got? Can we decommission things? Can we simplify? So we've got 43 forces all using quite often different technology. Can we come to some common standards, some common applications and services? Can we compromise on our individuality and create a kind of standardised commodity technology estate for policing, reduce the cost and complexity, make it easier to secure, and use the headroom that's created to invest in the things that are going to really add value? That would be my approach.
Yeah. And would you say that's similar for outside policing as well, Alistair?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everybody's trying to rebalance what you invest in. That's happening across all the industries. As technology moves so quickly, you know, the decisions have to be made about which ones you stop looking at, which ones you start looking at, which ones are going to really make the difference. But I think the major things we're seeing from the outside is the really trying to question the business benefit. Where do you get the business benefit from putting your money in? And that will be where does policing get its benefit, depending on what it invests in.
So again, just looking ahead, we've touched on there the importance of the human being part of the process, whatever that looks like in the future. In terms of preparedness for that, Gavin, there's two or three things that yourself as National MPCC Chair are doing with Chief Constables to prepare ourselves for that future.
One brilliant thing about how we're organised nationally at the moment, now we now have a Chief Scientific Advisor for policing. We've never had that in the past, with a team of wonderful people around, Professor Paul Taylor, doing that work, working very closely with their colleagues in other trusted nations where they're working on similar issues. So the global collaboration on science and innovation is really strong, as it is across sectors, you know, working with colleagues that are on military development. So we're now much more invested in thinking about the future, in forward planning, looking at the different technology readiness levels as to, you know, what's going to be around in a year's time to help us out, what might be around in 5 years' time to help us out, getting prepared for those. That definitely helps. We've touched on it earlier in this conversation, but I think the thing that we need to sort of bring up the track next is the public involvement, the community dialogue in that, the ethics and understanding, the transparency. We're definitely going to need to do that. Again, just shifting it away from the sort of data and information bit and thinking about just modes of transport, for example, how we respond to things in future is going to look very different, isn't it? So the amount of unmanned aerial activity that we're going to see in our skies in the future, I mean, we've all seen the films. Some of that is going to look familiar. You know, you're going to get a package delivered to your front door by a drone, so you can expect the police to be responding by a drone. Some of those projects are really exciting. And for people not to be afraid of that, to know that it might help find their loved one more quickly if they go missing, or to be able to respond to a crime in action, to give us some situational awareness, engaging the public in those sorts of debates, I think that's where we need to put our energy next.
So should the public be worried?
Worried in the sense that the nature of crime is changing, so we need to be as vigilant about how people can harm us online as we are vigilant as to how people can harm us in our homes. So I think a much greater awareness as to how to keep yourself safe in this new era. A little bit of worry about that is a good thing. Not overly worried, but we ought to think about how to protect ourselves. But in terms of being able to trust the police about us using this wisely, no, definitely not be worried, because right at the core of what we will do is we cannot police without confidence. We probably will take some missteps, but we don't want to take too many missteps to lose that confidence, because everything else becomes so much more difficult if we get that wrong.
And Tony, from your side, obviously, Gavin's touched on some of the building blocks already to prepare for the future. Is there anything else from the work you're doing at the minute?
Absolutely. We now have a science and innovation coordinating committee, so there's now a dedicated part of NPCC that's looking to the future. We have an AI strategy being developed. We have an AI covenant that's been published by Paul Taylor's office. So I think that we're starting to get into the kind of getting ahead of the technology and thinking about things in the future more effectively. We are going to go through a prioritisation process to start asking ourselves those hard questions about what we stop doing and what's important to us, and doing some really boring foundational things, like we've just set up a data office for national policing that's going to sort out data standards, data availability, data quality. If you want to run AI, improve your data, make it available, and you'll get better outcomes. A national analytics service, so working with the police digital service, having the ability to take advanced analytic tools like the one we have for ANPR that can find a county lines drug dealer who's got no previous record with the police, who, based on the use of vehicle data, making those things available to every force, not just individual forces, making sure that every force can exploit advanced analytics. Those are kind of some of the foundational things that we need to do that's going to really turn things around for the future.
And obviously, looking outside again, policing, Alistair, and obviously lots of challenges, lots of unknowns going forward. How do you think other partners can support policing to make sure we are delivering the very best with the money that we've got to keep our communities safe?
I mean, I think there's definitely a country, if not internationally, required need to look at how AI is used, how AI is constructed, and the weightings that go into putting non-bias into AI. I think that kind of from a commercial side of view, if you're putting a product or service out that uses AI, you should be very transparent about how it's been used, what it's been asked to do, where it's got its data from. All of those kind of things can help policing. If you get into the models now being more accessible to everybody, it won't be long before DNA resensing is taking the smell away from drugs, so drug dogs don't become useful anymore. All of these kind of things are going to happen. So the more we can control the models without being innovation limiting, I think that's the balance we need to find.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's like you say, it's again working together, isn't it? That's the key bit. We're both policing communities and importantly other sectors and partners to do everything we can to make sure the system is connected, but importantly as tight as it can to reduce the criminality. Okay, so conscious that we're coming towards the end of this episode, but fact or fiction then, just looking ahead, and again what we might do is write these down, and in 21 years time we might come back and say, actually, as this happening, so not to hold you to account, Gavin, or Tony, you hold to account many too much already, some would argue. So hacking into someone's wearable device to spy on them or gain access to their data, fact or fiction?
Fact. Happening now.
Okay, engineering performance enhancing drugs that are not detectable by anti-doping agencies.
Fact.
And you already get the answer to that, didn't you, Alistair, already? You helped the others already. That's partially working, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you can see a time when there's a device on your kitchen worktop that synthesises a substance for you that's a sort of chemical drug to you. I mean, the protection against that is human relationships, isn't it? And people not turning to those things. But you probably don't need to worry about a supply chain from overseas anymore. You're probably going to be able to do it in your own kitchen.
Okay, hacking into a city infrastructure to disable, destroy that proper functioning, so traffic lights, all that.
Well, look at last week.
Insider threat.
Yeah.
So the Crown Strike, really good example, isn't it, when technology fails and ultimately the impact and ultimately then other incidents over the last couple of months where cyber attacks and everything else around it as well.
Yeah, well, last week's wasn't a cyber attack, was it? We're talking about a few kilobyte software update, a virus protection that, you know, brings down the system. So guarding against the ability to cascade. And that's where we're going to need this crisis response, aren't we?
Yeah. You touched on this earlier on, actually, and again, it's that public worry or not. The end of theft through theft proof by design.
Well, in police crime prevention initiatives now, we've got a scheme called Secure Connected Devices, where manufacturers can come to police crime prevention initiatives, which is a National Police Chiefs Council body, and apply for certification that their connected device is secure. So, yeah, I think, you know, if we can work with the developers, then we should be able to design a lot of this house at source.
Having said that, problems have been publicised about Land Rovers being stolen with scanning devices and iPhones are still being stolen and exported to be broken down for parts.
And other vehicles before we upset Jaguar Land Rover.
Well, exactly. Yes. But yeah. It was in the news. The ability to a digitally secured vehicle without a physical key, somebody will find a way of breaking that security.
Yeah. Just a little story on that. Not long before I left Surrey, my last force, I went to see a colleague, Jeff, who works on vehicle crime with Roads Police, and then he threw a little bit of circuit board across the table at me. He said, "What do you think that is?" I said, "I have no idea, Jeff, you're going to have to tell me." And it was a false identity for a car. So installed behind the dashboard that effectively gave the car a false digital identity. Incredible.
Yeah, it is. Okay, the last one, RoboCop.
Sorry for the dog lovers, but definitely RoboDog.
Okay, why, Gavin?
We talked about sensors, having something that you can put into hostile environments at no risk to human or animal life, that's got the sensors on it that we need in order to be able to detect threat or detect life. That's just around the corner. I think will become commonplace in all sorts of different shapes and sizes.
I think the foundations are already there. So we're starting looking at robotic process automation where a digital worker is doing the work that a person used to do. You've got the trials in, I think, Japan, where in care homes they're trialing robots for doing patient care. It's an AI-assisted contact call centre, so looking at those sorts of things. You start combining those technologies over 20 years, I would be surprised if there wasn't some form of RoboCop support to a police officer.
I think it's going to end somewhere in the middle of those two. So if you look at other technologies that are going on with chips being put in people's brains to help them walk, to help them, you know, re-see things, actually using that technology on animals for them to be a data feed and be the one that can go into a dangerous area, be the one that can, you know, feed all the information back, sight, sound, smell, all of that comes as data. And then you can centrally monitor it. So somewhere in the middle of it all.
Okay, well, we'll see in 21 years' time, won't we, exactly where it lies. So firstly, a massive thank you for all your input today in the comments. Really, really helpful. I think the key takeaways for me is about, firstly, predicting the future is challenging, it's certain. But what's not so challenging and uncertain, I think you touched on it, Gavin, is around the importance of the public, about the importance of being public interface, about that building the trust you touched on, Alistair, earlier on, but also the public being aware of what is changing but not being alarmed by it realistically. And I think the last one for me, again, it goes back to policing is preparing now for the future. So it's not just waiting for it to happen, it's looking at what it can do now, and importantly that recognises it's not just internally within policing and the wider criminal justice system, the part that other partners can play as well. So a massive thank you, as I said, a massive thank you to Exception that's sponsoring these episodes. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast service. Again, in future episodes, we're going to talk more detail around artificial intelligence. Again, we're talking a little bit more around the impact on surveillance and again, the liberty bit, like facial recognition, Gavin. And then the input all the wider bit there about data. As you touched on, Tony, data is so, so important. If we get it up right, that makes a real difference as well. So for now, thank you very much. Till next time, thanks for listening.